So picture Moab for a second.
Okay.
You know, you've just finished this grueling, really dusty hike through the Red Rocks, and you walk up to that highly rated burger place right on Main Street, and the door is locked.
Oh, yeah. The storefront is totally dark.
Right. It's completely dark. And there's just this little handwritten sign taped to the window that says, closed, no staff.
Yeah.
And you look around, and the town is packed. Right? Tourists are everywhere. The demand is just off the charts. But the basic economic engine of the whole community has just totally stalled out.
It's a scene playing out literally everywhere. I mean, Jackson Hole, Telluride, Sedona,
Yeah.
basically every gateway community in the country. The demand for the outdoors just exploded over the last few years, but the towns themselves are, they're breaking under the weight of it.
Exactly. And that's exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. Because the source material we're looking at proves that there's actually no labor shortage in these towns.
Right, there are plenty of jobs.
Plenty of jobs. And there are plenty of willing workers who actively want to live and work in these beautiful places. But what we actually have is a housing crisis that has become mathematically impossible for the working class to navigate.
It's totally impossible.
So what do the workers do?
Yeah.
They adapt.
Yeah.
I mean, they start living in their trucks and their vans.
Right.
And how do the towns respond? They criminalize that exact adaptation with these really strict overnight parking bans.
Yeah. They essentially outlaw the only shelter their own workforce can afford, which creates this incredibly destructive loop.
Which is why our mission for this deep dive is to explore a fascinating kind of historically inspired blueprint for breaking that loop. So we're pulling from a very grounded, specific memo today. It's titled Memo 006, Park Here, Work Here, Build Here.
Great title.
Yeah. It was written by Mike Isaacs. He's the founder of Timber Outdoor, and this was published exclusively for a group called the Sovereign Circle, which is based out of Sierra County, New Mexico.
Right.
And what we're going to look at today is how this memo proposes solving the workforce housing crisis. And, you know, doing it not with some massive billion-dollar government program that takes 10 years to build,
Because we know how that goes.
right, but solving it with lightweight infrastructure and just a simple shift in perspective.
And what's fascinating here is that Isaacs doesn't start by painting city councils as villains.
Yeah, that surprised me.
Right. He doesn't dismiss the city's objections to vehicle living. He actually validates them, which is a really rare approach in this space
Totally.
because municipalities have entirely legitimate interests to protect. I mean, if you have hundreds of untracked individuals moving from, say, a grocery store parking lot to a quiet neighborhood street,
Playing cat and mouse.
exactly. That creates a genuine administrative nightmare. Cities have to worry about public safety. They have to worry about sanitation.
Right.
And fundamentally, they have to maintain a tax and administrative relationship with the people using city services.
I hear that, but you know, it's like a town realizing it has a leak in the roof, and instead of grabbing a bucket or fixing the shingle, they just ban the rain.
Yeah.
Like, passing a law doesn't actually solve the reality of the weather. But okay, let's unpack this. Isaacs claims these municipal concerns are entirely solvable.
They are.
How does a town actually build an administrative relationship with someone living in a Tacoma? Like, how do you get tax revenue from a transient population without forcing them into a 12-month apartment lease that they obviously can't afford?
Well, the memo introduces a very pragmatic first step, which is a designated overnight parking program.
Okay.
So instead of a city playing this endless, exhausting game of whack-a-mole, paying police overtime to chase vans out of public parks at 2 in the morning,
Right.
they create a safe zone. Workers check in between 10 p.m. and they check out by 7 a.m.
Wait, a structured window? Just a place to park at night?
Yeah, exactly.
But if I'm a city planner, I'm immediately asking how that pays for itself. And more importantly, if these workers are living in their cars because they're broke, how are they supposed to afford another municipal fee on like a line cook's salary? Doesn't that just put us back at square one?
Well, that's the assumption most people make, right? But the math actually tells a completely different story.
Okay.
The weekly registration fee to park in this safe zone is modest. It's calibrated specifically to a hospitality wage, not some luxury vacation RV rate.
Got it.
And if that worker is employed by a local participating business, the fee drops even further.
Oh, so there's an incentive.
Exactly. Think about the economics of someone who isn't paying $2,000 a month for a studio apartment.
Right, yeah.
A nominal weekly fee is entirely manageable for them. And for the city, that fee creates a dedicated revenue stream to actually manage the program.
Okay, so the city suddenly gets a database.
Yes.
Like, if I register, I'm no longer a ghost parking behind the hardware store. I'm a trackable, fee-paying resident contributing to the system.
And you gain legal standing, you know? You get a safe place to sleep without the anxiety of a flashlight shining in your window at 3 a.m. It essentially restores dignity to the worker and control to the city.
Sure, a fee might solve the paperwork, but it doesn't solve the biology.
Right, right.
Like, legalizing a parking spot addresses the sleep issue, but if you just pack 50 cars into a designated dirt lot, you have a massive sanitation problem.
Oh, absolutely.
Where are these workers showering before their shift at the ski lodge? Where are they going to the bathroom? That's the stuff that triggers public health red flags and, quite frankly, outrages the local residents.
Yeah, an isolated parking lot is not a housing solution. It's just a sanctioned camp.
Right.
To make this a functional residence, you need a supporting physical framework.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the memo points out that America already solved this exact problem.
Yes.
We solved overnight vehicle parking, centralized sanitation, community safety, and municipal revenue over 40 years ago.
Yep. The American Drive-In Theater. It's brilliant. Think about the mechanics of the drive-in.
Oh, it makes perfect sense when you look at it.
Right. Families would pay a per-car fee at the gate. They'd pull into this giant, unpaved lot on the edge of town, park, walk over to a central concession building for popcorn.
Yep.
They'd use the public restrooms right there in the middle of the lot, watch the movie, and then drive home.
And nobody filed sanitation complaints against drive-ins.
Never.
Nobody passed emergency city ordinances to ban vehicles from the lot after dark because the impact was entirely contained and managed by that central infrastructure.
And these businesses were permitted everywhere, like suburban lots, rural fields, land that was just waiting for future development.
Right.
There were these massive paved or dirt footprints that ran profitably for decades.
And so the memo takes that deeply nostalgic model and asks, what does this look like updated for 2026? They call it the drive-in 2.0 model, which acts as the physical blueprint for a concept they call Prosperity Place. Okay, so if we are updating the drive-in for 2026, I'm guessing we don't need the massive projector screen or the little metal speakers you hang on your window.
Right, no speakers.
The footprint is the same, a big lot for the cars. But what actually goes inside that central concession building now?
Well, you still have the snacks and the coffee.
Nice.
But that central building is now outfitted with clean, high-capacity showers, laundry facilities, and connected workspaces. The hours remain defined in by dark, out by morning. The attraction isn't a Hollywood double feature anymore.
The attraction is the ski mountain.
Exactly.
Or it's the river you're guiding on tomorrow.
Precisely. The worker pulls in after their shift at the restaurant. They grab a quick meal from the concession stand, take a hot shower, do a load of laundry.
Yeah.
They go to sleep safely in their truck and wake up ready for the next day.
That completely shifts the psychological framework of how we view this population. Because it's the infrastructure that dictates societal perception, right?
Right.
Like, if you were sleeping in a van and brushing your teeth in a gas station sink, society looks at that as a desperate survival situation.
Yeah, it feels chaotic.
Yeah, chaotic. But if you were sleeping in that same van and waking up to use a clean, dedicated shower facility and answering emails in a connected workspace before your shift, well, that changes the whole narrative.
It absolutely does. It elevates the behavior from a public health concern to a deliberate, dignified lifestyle choice.
Right.
Isaacs makes a crucial point in the text. The difference between desperation and functionality is almost entirely a function of available infrastructure.
Wow.
The worker hasn't changed. The vehicle hasn't changed. What changed is their access to basic human hygiene and a sense of belonging.
Okay. The drive-in 2.0 concept is incredibly cool in theory, but, you know, if I'm a city manager, I am terrified of the red tape required to build a massive new shower and laundry facility. How do we get around a 10-year environmental impact study? Because a vision is just a cool idea until it gets crushed by a local zoning board.
Well, this is where the memo gets highly tactical. It avoids the trap of vague policy suggestions and lays out a very specific, bounded, four-step regulatory ask for local governments.
Okay.
Timber Outdoor even includes a free 30-day quick start checklist and a model ordinance PDF. A city manager can download it today and hand it directly to their city attorney.
That's smart. Let's run through these four steps because I really want to see how this actually bypasses the usual bureaucratic nightmare.
Sure.
So step one is designate the zones. The memo suggests identifying 2 to 4 locations per community. And I'm guessing the strategy here is location. You put them near transit lines or in light industrial areas, far away from residential subdivisions, right?
Yeah, you have to account for human nature. If you try to put this next to a quiet cul-de-sac, you will trigger an immediate, not in my backyard panic from homeowners worried about property values.
Oh, guaranteed.
By placing these zones in commercial or light industrial spaces, you know, places that are already dormant at night, the city avoids that political friction entirely.
That makes sense.
And the city doesn't have to pour concrete or build anything. They simply draw a boundary on a map and pass an ordinance permitting overnight parking in that specific polygon.
Got it. So step two is create the permit system, which ties into that database we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
A simple weekly registration connecting the vehicle to local employment.
Right. Then step three is the engine that makes this all run without bankrupting the town, which is partner with private infrastructure providers.
Okay.
The memo is adamant that the city should not use public taxpayer funds to build these Prosperity Place facilities.
Wait. If the city isn't funding the showers and the laundry, who is?
Private operators.
But why would a private business operator invest heavy capital to build a campus for a transient workforce? Most people assume workforce housing requires massive government subsidies because low-wage workers don't have money.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it fundamentally comes down to disposable income.
Okay.
That assumption that these workers are broke is based on the traditional model where they hand over 60 or 70% of their paycheck to a landlord.
Right.
But look at the demographics of the workers in this program. They have stable local employment and they have absolutely zero rent burden.
Oh, wow. Right.
Because they aren't bleeding $2,000 a month for a cramped apartment, that line cook actually has a significant amount of discretionary cash.
Significantly more relative disposable income than a conventional renter in that exact same market.
That is wild.
So if a private operator builds a clean, safe, well-run facility and charges a fair weekly fee for parking, showers, and workspace, these workers can easily afford it.
Yeah.
And while the population might seem transient from season to season, it's actually remarkably stable over a multi-year horizon.
Awesome. If a worker has a great setup in Telluride for the winter, they're going to come back to that exact same Prosperity Place lot next winter. Retaining that customer base creates a highly profitable, recurring revenue business model for the private operator.
That completely flips the script. These workers aren't an economic drain on the city. They are a highly concentrated, incredibly reliable consumer base for this specific type of infrastructure.
Isaac.
It's a profitable business, not a subsidized charity.
Right.
Which brings us to the final piece of the puzzle, step four. Suspend the vehicle dwelling bans, but only in participating zones and only for permit holders.
And this is a vital legal distinction. The memo is not advocating for blanket amnesty, allowing anyone to sleep in a car anywhere in town.
Right, the chaos.
That would be political suicide for a city council. By keeping the ban in effect on neighborhood streets, the town protects its broader interests. But within the designated zone, the worker in the managed program is recognized and protected.
It's a carrot and stick approach. But for once, the carrot is actually attainable. Now, we spent a lot of time on policy frameworks, zoning maps, and business models. But what I really appreciate about Isaac's memo is that it grounds all of this theory in a real human story at the end.
Yes.
Because if we don't understand the lived experience of the person this is designed for, we miss the actual impact.
Without the human element, it just remains an abstract policy paper. The human outcome is the entire point of the exercise.
So the source material walks us through this scenario. Let's picture a woman driving into one of these gateway towns.
Okay.
She's got her truck, and it's outfitted with specific timber outdoor gear. The memo highlights two things, a RAAK modular kitchen system in the bed of her truck and a canopy overhead shade system.
And, you know, these aren't just aesthetic camping accessories. They serve a very specific functional purpose that directly addresses those municipal concerns we talked about.
How so? Like, if I'm a city planner, why do I care if she has a modular kitchen?
Well, you care about sanitation. If a worker doesn't have a proper setup, they might wash their frying pan on the curb and dump gray water straight into the street gutter.
Oh, yeah.
And that triggers a furious phone call from a local business owner to the city. A system like the RAA manages that cooking process and contains the gray water. It makes the individual self-sufficient without impacting the surrounding environment.
That makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And the canopy shade, why does that matter to the town?
That addresses the psychological side. Living in the cab of a truck can feel incredibly claustrophobic.
Yeah, I bet.
If a worker feels confined, they burn out, they quit their job mid-season, and the local restaurant is short-staffed again, the shade structure expands their livable footprint to the outside of the vehicle.
Like a patio.
Exactly. It creates a porch. That simple expansion of space prevents burnout and ensures she remains a stable, happy employee for the whole season.
So she drives into town equipped with this gear. Under this new framework, she registers her vehicle on a Monday and gets her permit.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, she starts her shift at the local launch. Before her shift, she heads over to Prosperity Place, uses the hot shower, gets cleaned up, and goes to work.
Yeah.
On her days off, she deploys her canopy in the designated lot, cooks on her modular kitchen, and maybe uses the connected workspace at the concession building to take an online course.
She is living a fully integrated, functional life within that community. She is a productive economic participant, not a burden.
But the absolute mic drop of the whole memo is the timeline.
Yes.
Because she's living this way, utilizing the communal infrastructure without the crushing burden of traditional rent in 6 months, she saves more money than she did in 2 whole years of paying rent in her previous city.
That stat alone exposes the staggering reality of the rent burden in America right now.
It's crazy.
Traditional housing is actively keeping the working class poor.
Yeah. In 18 months under this vehicle-based model, she has saved enough for a down payment on a piece of land.
Think about that.
In 3 years, her entire economic trajectory has changed. She has financial leverage and options she never would have had if she was trapped on the treadmill of the traditional rental market.
And that really synthesizes the most powerful argument from Isaacs's text. We have been conditioned to view the vehicle as the problem.
Right.
But in this paradigm, the vehicle is the solution. The truck, the modular kitchen, the shade canopy, that is the micro-infrastructure of a self-reliant life.
Okay.
And the permitted parking zone, combined with the Prosperity Place facility, is the macro infrastructure that makes that self-reliant life actually sustainable.
It's like all the puzzle pieces finally snapping together to form a completely different picture.
And the memo makes it very clear. This is not some romanticized van life fantasy pushed by social media influencers selling a lifestyle.
Right. No filters here.
No. This is a hard-nosed, deeply practical economic strategy for the working class. It is a legitimate mechanism for wealth building for people who have been entirely priced out of conventional real estate. But it only works if the city is willing to update its institutional imagination and simply permit her to park.
So what does this all mean for you listening? It means these gateway towns, these beautiful outdoor communities, are staring down a very stark, very binary choice.
Yeah.
They can adopt this framework. They can draw a line on a map, partner with private operators to build out the drive-in 2.0, and create a permitted, dignified path for their workforce. And if they do, they get to enjoy open restaurants, fully staffed ski lodges, and a thriving local economy.
Or they can cling to the status quo. They can keep passing new variations of overnight parking bans. They can keep staring at empty storefronts. And they can keep writing bewildered op-eds for the local paper, wondering where all the workers went.
Like, why doesn't anyone want to work anymore? Well, they do. You just outlawed their bed. This deep dive challenges so many deeply held societal assumptions we have about what constitutes a valid way to live. We have been taught to equate dignity with a mortgage or a 12-month lease.
Right.
But this memo shows how treating a vehicle as a legitimate, efficient dwelling, when paired with the right communal infrastructure, can solve seemingly intractable economic crises.
Oh.
It forces us to ask if our housing crisis is actually just a crisis of imagination.
It absolutely does. And, you know, it raises an important question, something that lingers just beyond the edges of the memo's immediate policy goals.
What's that?
If this model of mobile infrastructure-supported living becomes widely accepted, if it becomes an economically advantageous, deliberate path for a whole generation of workers, how might that permanently change our future definition of what it means to be a local?
Oh, wow.
Right. If your home moves, but your community is tethered to the infrastructure and the towns you cycle through season after season, how will the next generation define the very concept of a hometown?
That is a massive shift to think about. A completely different way of rooting yourself in the world. And it all starts with walking past that closed restaurant, looking at the dark storefront, and realizing that the solution might just be waiting out in the parking lot.